south of the border, down Mexico way. That's where I fell in love when the stars above came out to play. And now as I wander.
Hello there, all you expat wannabes. I'm Johnny Mueller, and you're listening to The Expat Files, Living in Latin America, the show that tells you just what it's like to live, work, play, and or retire down here in Latin America. It's a mix of the good, the bad, the ugly, and the great, and it's all right here, so let's get started. Okay, we've all heard about that terrible bee die-off that's been happening over the past 4 or 5 years up in the States. Many of you know all about that, those of you who listen to alternative media. Because, you know, you never get the real poop from the idiot talking heads that are owned by the 6 gigantic media corporations. Anyway, a lot of you expat gonna-bes and wannabes out there would really like to come down to Latin America, buy yourself a piece of land, and do some kind of farming, or maybe you just want to get off the grid and want to get into a more self-sufficient mode. And believe me, it's so easy to do down here, especially when you're in one of the Altiplano regions. And, you know, I don't mind admitting I was a clueless gringo when I first came down here, too. I didn't even know what the Altiplano was till about 5 years into being an expat down here. I always thought you had to be in 90 to 100 degree weather all the time, miserably hot and constantly with a coat of sweat on your body, meaning you have to have air conditioning all the time. Now, of course, you see a lot of Latin American people, especially indigenous folks, living on the sides of mountains and steep hills. Nice cool weather up there if you don't mind living like a goat or a llama. Those seemed to be my two alternatives when I first came down as a clueless gringo. How was I to know about the Altiplano? I always wonder why in my geography class in high school and junior high, no mention of the Altiplano. I guess it was and still remains one of the world's best-kept geography secrets. So was it a conspiracy of silence or just first-world geography teachers showing their own incomplete educations? Anyway, for all you guys and gals up in the first world who would like to come down, get back to nature, maybe get off the grid, get your own piece of land, grow things or raise critters, whatever, I'd like to mention that one of the booming businesses down here in Latin America is raising bees for honey, which seems to fly in the face of what's been happening up in the first world where beekeepers are really struggling and hives that were very viable just a couple of years ago are now defunct, which tends to do what? Raise prices worldwide, supply and demand, right? Well, that said, let me read you an excerpt from a Spanish-language Latin American business journal that just came out this week. It says, Latin American honey exportation and production is up 10 to, get this, 45% over last year, depending what Latin country you're talking about. Whereas honey production up in the States is down about 18% over last year. So how does that jive? Oh, and by the way, according to agricultural experts in Latin America, they say honeybees in the region are responsible for the pollination of between 10 and 25% of all coffee plants. Which makes sense in why I've noticed that so much of the honey you get down here, especially at mom and pop roadside stands, has a very slight tinge and aroma of coffee. Wouldn't you like to try some of that? So yes, down here they have thousands and thousands of mom and pop operations. Almost none of them produce honey exclusively. They have cows and chickens and maybe a few lemon or avocado trees. They're all just small and medium-sized mom-and-pop operations. Oh, and by the way, though Latin America may be the second biggest honey-producing region in the world, do you know what the first is? Nope, not the U.S. China. Yes, China produces hundreds of thousands of tons of chemically tainted honey every year. You've probably enjoyed a few toxic spoonfuls yourself. Yum, yum. Oh, and by the way, they've been caught mixing it with other cheaper sugars and additives to thin it out and extend it, of course. Who's going to know, huh? Oh, and by the way, this article says that every bee colony in Latin America produces an average of 50 pounds of bulk honey a year. And here's something else I don't quite get. Up in the States, raw bulk honey, you know, wholesale, goes for around $2.50 to $3 a pound. Oddly enough, down here, you can buy it in one-pound jars at one of the local little tiendas for the same U.S. wholesale bulk price or less. So how is that possible down here? Are they thinning it with some other crap like the Chinese do? Nope, it's all about the fact that it's a manual labor process. Just know that Latin American agricultural workers make minimum wage and sometimes much less. In fact, I personally spoke to agricultural workers out in the boonies, and some of them only make $6 or $8 a day. That's half the normal, ridiculously low Latin American minimum wage, which is why so many young kids out in the boonies migrate to the big city, where they can actually get a minimum wage job in one of those big factory maquilas, you know, making Nike shoes or whatever. Or maybe they'll hit the jackpot and get a job at McDonald's, Wendy's, Pizza Hut, or Kentucky Fried. Then you get a real uniform and a permanent case of acne to go along with it. Or is acne a prerequisite for the job? I don't know. Sounds like a good master's thesis to me. Imagine how the abstract might read. The unusual predilection of acne in the fast food industry. Or something like that. You get the idea. So, you psych and sociology majors, you heard it here first. Go ahead and run with it. But I digress. Boy, do I digress. Anyway, there's absolutely no talk whatsoever down here of bee colony collapse. Now, as it turns out, the vast majority of beekeepers, the mom-and-pop beekeepers, they don't even know what colony collapse is. However, the bigger honey producers keep up with that stuff, you know. They've got their own organization, and they belong to their country's import-export group, because they need to know the ever-changing international food regulations, etc. In fact, all beekeeping organizations in any particular Latin country offer classes and courses on how you, too, can become a beekeeper. Because as one beekeeper told me, they're never lacking for a market, the world's always ready to buy their product, and in fact, if you are a beekeeper, you can join the local beekeeping organization where they have a co-op. You bring your honey down and they'll buy it for what I guess right now is about $1 to $1.50 a pound, which, by the way, is about half the world bulk honey price, as I mentioned before. Oh, and another thing, one of the Latin beekeeper guys I know actually gave me an instructional CD on how to start your own colonies and manage your bees. Yes, I looked at it, and it's a course done by a mom-and-pop beekeeping family up in the States, no less. And predictably, a Latin person got a hold of it, pirated it, and placed a Spanish-language soundtrack on it. So you can watch it in English or in Spanish. And, you know, about one-third of it is dedicated to keeping your colony alive during the winter when there's snow and frost. Down here, not a problem, which makes beekeeping even easier south of the border. Now, as far as the numbers, is this going to work out for you financially? Well, like I said before, if the average bee colony puts out 50 pounds a year, and let's say it can be sold off at the local wholesale co-op for $75, that means if you had 100 such bee colonies, you'd make around $7,500 a year. Now, I know what you're thinking. 100 colonies? That seems like a lot of work, and it is. But here's the point. Those beehive stacks take up very little space. And the way these mom-and-pop beekeepers work, they've got a full-time employee. They pay that person about $2,000 a year. That's all agricultural workers do get down here. That means a mom-and-pop farmer with 100 bee colonies and a full-time worker could probably clear about $5,000 a year. And like one of these beekeepers told me, the cool thing is, your full-time guy does all the work. You do basically nothing except monitor, quality control, and eventually bring this stuff to market. So that's a nice no-brainer for an expat. However, like the beekeeper said, you have to know bees if you go into the business. So take one of those courses or study, and that's half the battle. So there's a cool expat idea for you. In fact, I know an expat who did just that. He bought an acre or two alongside of a small river, only 15 or 20 kilometers outside of a big Latin city. So he's out in the boonies, but he's got instant access to everything a big city has to offer. He created a label and a little marketing campaign for himself, and now he sells boutique honey on Amazon. Yep, $12 to $15 a pound, and he also sells holiday and special occasion gift sets, too. So in the end, he's making about 10 times as much as the average beekeeper down here. So he says, for example, if he gets 50 pounds a year out of each colony, after expenses, he makes over $500. So work out the numbers. If he has 100 colonies, he makes about $50,000 a year, living like an absolute king. But he doesn't have 100 colonies. Too much work, he says. He's only got about 30, which brings him about $15,000 a year. So that, along with his Social Security check, which he says was worth about $13,000 a year, allows him to live, he says, better than he ever lived up in the first world. And by the way, up in the States, he was not a rocket scientist. He was a Minnesota junior high school janitor. Oh, and by the way, almost all the Latin agricultural universities down here, and there are a ton of them, They offer courses on how to grow, manage, market, and sell any Latin American cash crop. Coconuts, pineapples, avocados, macadamias, bananas, whatever. So if you come down here and want to dip a toe in the aggie business, you will be learning hands-on and from the experts. And though all those courses are dirt cheap, they are in Spanish. Okay, and another little bit of Latin news this week. Presently, there's an important financial and economic meeting going on in Uruguay. The Uruguayan government is discussing what kind of price controls they're going to put on basic goods and services. There have been some minor controls in place, but they're planning on expanding them. Now, if you remember, in a past show I mentioned, there are a few Latin countries that do have price controls on basic services like food and transportation. Now, since this audience is a rather enlightened crowd, you wouldn't be listening to alternative media if you weren't. You know that when a country institutes price controls, it's a prelude to big economic problems. Just note, throughout history, go look it up, you'll find out when countries become economic basket cases, one of the first things they do is institute price controls. That said, how about this quote by a Brazilian non-governmental economist? He says right now in 2015, Brazil is becoming Argentina, Argentina is becoming Venezuela, and Venezuela is becoming Zimbabwe. Of course, what he failed to mention was that the U.S. is becoming Mexico. Like, I have to point that out to you, right? Anyway, all of those Latin countries, by the way, have had price controls on basic goods for a while now. And now you got Bolivia, Ecuador, and Uruguay jumping on the bandwagon. So, bottom line, be very careful if one of those countries happens to be your expat destination of choice. Nice places to visit, except for Venezuela, but I wouldn't want to live there. Oh, but there's opportunities, you say. You read Doug Casey, right? He's always talking about Argentina and those great opportunities. Sure, there are opportunities in every Latin country, even Costa Rica, which I'm totally against living or investing in. That said, you can make a good living and a good life and a good buck anywhere. But note, where there's price controls, there's an underlying cancer in the system. And unless you consider yourself a very creative, adventurous chance taker, there are many better and more stable Latin countries to consider. Oh, I know, some of you are thinking I left out Cuba on that feces list. Well, of course, it's the price control basket case country of all time. In fact, most outside economists will tell you the only reason why Cuba's population isn't starving to death is because Cubans and their relatives living up in the States are sending back more than $1 billion a year in remesas. Without all that dough flowing in every year, Cuba would be the Western Hemisphere's Bangladesh. You can bet, without those remesas, you'd see Sting and Bob Geldof and Bono in another Live Aid-type concert toking on cohibas with the Castro brothers. Now, speaking of Brazil, I'm going to read a little bit of this article that's going to blow your mind. Now, as you know, I generally don't read whole articles. I ad-lib a bit. Articles are, well, just too dry, but this one you got to hear. A report from Sao Paulo, Brazil. It starts out, when Rosalanja Arruyo, a public school supervisor, turned 44. She did what millions of other Brazilians in their 40s and 50s have done. She retired with full pension. She took advantage of the benefit that was due all public employees in Brazil. Her government pension, by the way, stands at about $1,000 a month. That's five times the Brazilian minimum wage. Brazilians on average retire at the age of 54, and public servants, military officials, and politicians manage to not only retire before age 54, an amazing number manage to collect multiple government pensions totaling well over $100,000 a year. That would be 50 times the amount the average non-government pensioner gets. Let me stop here for a second. Now, that might sound familiar because a lot of that goes on up in the States, you know. In fact, in a past show, I know I mentioned a U.S. government law enforcement officer I met down here in Central America who's triple-dipping and making over $250,000 in pensions a year. One as a retired sheriff, one as a retired police officer, and one as a retired air marshal, etc., etc. And you know, when he kind of bragged and told me that, two thoughts ran through my mind. First, I wanted to throw him under a chicken bus, and second, I'm embarrassed to say, I was momentarily jealous of the jerk. So, Brazil's got all of that and more. Brazil public servants, military officials, and politicians manage these $100,000-a-year-plus pensions. Then, once they die, certain laws and loopholes enable their spouses, children, and or relatives to go on collecting their entire pensions for the rest of their natural lives, too. Then it goes on to say, this phenomena is so common in Brazil's vast public bureaucracy that scholars are calling it the Viagra effect, because retired civil servants, many in their 60s, 70s, and 80s, wed very much younger women who then are entitled to the full pensions for decades and decades after their spouses are gone. And young Brazilian women are well aware of it. There are thousands of blogs to that effect. In fact, it's become an industry. Psychologists say it's having a twisted effect on the culture. These days, 20-something young ladies marrying 70- and 80-year-old guys, that's becoming a somewhat standard practice in Brazil. And the old guys? Almost always ex-government workers. Now, according to Brazilian economist Paulo Toffner, when talking about the pension situation, he says, think Greece, but on a crazier, more colossal scale. The entire country, he says, should be frightened to its core. The pensions Brazilians obtain and the ages at which they start receiving them are nothing less than scandalous. The whole thing is a slow-motion train wreck. Now, the problem, of course, is the Brazilian Congress. They keep voting to perpetuate the inequality by providing special benefits to hundreds of thousands of government employees and their families, of which they're a part. For example, more than 185,000 women who are daughters of dead military officials still receive the full pension of their fathers. Economists are saying there will be a financial train wreck soon because Congress won't vote down pensions. They know they'll never get reelected if they ask for cuts. And though in the rest of the world, unions are weak, dead, or broken, in Brazil, it's just the opposite. Unions are very powerful, just like they were back in the U.S. in the 60s. In Brazil, all unions are rejecting calls to scale back benefits. And by the way, the article says that Brazil is one of the only countries in the world where you can retire and receive a government pension, even if you've never contributed to the public pension system. In Brazil, minimum wage workers, when they retire, receive a monthly payment equal to that minimum wage, about $210 a month these days. Whereas most government workers in Brazil make 2 to 3 times as much as the equivalent worker in the private sector. And they retire on full salary, too. Okay, that said, you know I talk about the good, the bad, the ugly, and the great in Latin America. And of course, that story about Brazil was ugly. How about let's get even more ugly? The other day I was talking to a Latin insurance claims adjuster. Yes, they've got him down here. Anyway, we were having this conversation in Spanish, and I was mentioning how many brand new SUVs I'm seeing down here in Latin America. I'm amazed how many new ones have showed up in the past year or so. And of course, the reason for that is not because there's so much more money down here. It's the fact that car dealers, for the first time in history, are offering their own financing, and for the first time in history, no money down. Sound familiar? Which means so many people are now qualifying that could never have before. The insurance adjuster just rolled his eyes and said, they can afford the car, but not the gas. Then he said, funny you should mention SUVs. He said, there's a new car theft scam going around in Latin America now, something that just wasn't on the radar a year or so ago. He said, in the past, car thieves would just select an SUV or a light new pickup truck from a parking lot, start it up with a master key for that model, pull the wires from the alarm speaker, have a duplicate parking ticket, and just drive out, then go to a nearby chop shop. There, they'd decide whether to use it for parts or just change the VIN numbers. If it was worth retitling, they'd have an accomplice at the vehicle registration department who'd issue a new title and paperwork with the new VIN numbers. Then, they'd drive that car to an adjacent country where they'd sell it with a new title. For example, if the car was stolen in Nicaragua, they'd drive it to Salvador or Honduras, and that's where it would end up, forever. But now, in the last year or two, there's much more title and registration security, and computers at the borders are now connected to the vehicle registration department. That said, if a car's had its VIN numbers changed and a new title issued, the way thieves have been doing it for so many years, up till now anyway, when it hits the border station, The immigration and aduana agents are going to see that car never entered the country. It's only exiting. That VIN number will not be in the computer. There'll be no record it ever came into the country and paid taxes. Red flags will go up all over the place. So, linked computerized systems have kind of made it impossible to steal cars the old way. But you know, since when has that stopped car thieves? So anyway, the insurance adjuster said the new scheme goes like this. The bad guys in any Latin country know where the expensive, high-end gated communities are, where all the nice late-model pickup trucks and SUVs reside. Now remember, most all these gated communities have a guard station where you have to check in and show your license or flash it in front of a scanner, or if you live there, you'll have a residential sticker on your windshield. And when the guard sees that and recognizes the car, he waves you right through. So anyway, the bad guys are a couple blocks away from the guard entrance. It could be in a little tienda or maybe just a busy street. And they watch those SUVs and pickups go in and out of the guard station. And they decide which SUV they're going to steal. They'll plan this usually for a few weeks and even follow that car as it leaves the guard station. And when it stops in a mall or commercial center, they'll watch who gets out, man or woman, if there's kids along or a bodyguard along. The best target being a woman with no bodyguard. Now, generally, there's an inside man. He gets into that subdivision and he checks out that house where the car is parked. So then you might ask, how does he get past all that security? Could he be one of the guards himself, or maybe part of the maintenance crew that's cleaning the roads in the complex? Could be, but more often it's like this. Generally, there's a guy hiding in the back of the garbage truck that comes in two or three times a week to collect. In Latin America, you'll soon note that garbage trucks are not sophisticated. They're just big old dilapidated moving van trucks just packed with garbage. And oddly enough, there can be three, four, even five guys to a garbage truck. Normally, a driver, a guy riding shotgun, and two or three guys in the back keeping the garbage company. Now, naturally, when a garbage truck pulls up to one of these subdivisions, he's waved through. No one will ever go back and check that garbage out. It's disgusting. Who'd want to? So, it's dead easy to stash an extra person or two way back in with the garbage. Now, remember, these garbage guys are making minimum wage and all they can eat. So you gotta know, if some gang of car thieves pays these guys $10 a piece, they'll let anyone who looks the part ride or hide in the back. So then here's how the rest of it works. That guy jumps off the truck, hides nearby the Mark's house in the bushes or brush, whatever. He could be there for a couple hours, but he does know the owner's schedule. He'll know when she goes out shopping or to the beauty parlor or to pick up the kids or to go to the health club. He's got that planned already. So anyway, when she arrives back from her errands or whatever, and either hits the garage door opener or perhaps she parks in the driveway out in front, he puts on his stocking mask and sneaks into the garage before the door closes. He surprises her with a gun in the face and says, "Give me the papers for the car and the circulation," which is that laminated plastic card cops will ask for if you're ever stopped or pulled over at one of those roadblocks. It signifies that car is legally registered and that the license fees have been paid for the year. That's all the cops really care about. As long as it can be produced, the cops will wave you right on by. It doesn't matter if your name is on that title or that little circulation card or not. Because remember, many people own their cars and their houses, etc., with SA corporations, so there won't be anyone's name on that card or title. So that's what the crook wants. He can drive anywhere as long as he's got the original circulation card, which most people do not carry with them in their car. They carry a certified copy, which is good enough within the country. However, you can't go across borders with that, only the original, which is why the guy wants to steal the car while you're at home so he can get the original from you. So anyway, he follows the lady into the house. They go to the office, wherever the paperwork is. He takes it. They get into the car. He's driving. She shows him where the hidden alarm buttons are, etc. They drive out past the guard. He knows the car and sees the subdivision window sticker. And remember, in Latin America, SUVs and pickups and almost all cars have heavy tinted windows. Most often, you can never tell who's in the car, much less if it's a man or a woman. Okay, next step, the guy hits the open road and heads for the nearest country. And remember, within most of Latin America, countries are quite small and you can usually hit a border within 2 or 3 hours, no matter where you are. And then, since most borders are way out in the boonies, He'll drop the woman off a couple miles before the border. Maybe he'll even knock her out. He'll pass right through with all the right paperwork. And on the other side, his crew will be waiting. They'll switch the VIN numbers and the plates, and they'll retitle it there as a car that came in from the U.S. And by the time the car's reported stolen in the home country, it'll take at least 4 days for all that info to get up on government computers and with the police force, etc. Even so, it won't matter, because countries do not communicate stolen car information back and forth. Not in Latin America. Not yet. Once a stolen car's driven into an adjacent country, there's almost no country-to-country cooperation between police authorities, so the car can be considered permanently gone. Now, the moral of the story, of course, is that you don't want to have a car that thieves want to steal, like a late model SUV or shiny new pickup truck. But you knew that already, right? Okay, let me take this time to remind you that my January 2016 Latin Insider Seminar is all set and ready to go. Check out the information and sign-up link, www.thenewexpat.com, and click on the seminar link at the top of the page. Now, don't forget, as of the date this show goes out, that will be Friday, October 23rd, you've got 7 days to sign up and get that $500 per person early bird discount. So come on down to my seminar and get a 2 to 5 year head start on your own plans. That would be your plan B, becoming an expat in Latin America. You do have a plan B, right? If you don't, let me ask you one question. What are you going to do when you wake up and turn on your TV and they tell you none of the ATM machines in the country are working? That's going to happen, you know. And if it's not Chinese or Russian hackers, it'll be your own government and a false flag. But whatever it is, you better have that plan B. So come on down. Oh, and how about this for great news? At our new website, www.thenewexpat.com, we'll soon be featuring a blog written by a trusted Latin lawyer friend of mine. That's right, a Latin lawyer will be blogging regularly on everything you want to know about Latin legal issues such as residency passports, contracts, SA corporations, banking, trusts, courts, lawsuits, and much, much more. And better yet, you'll be able to email him personally with your own legal questions too. So stay tuned for that. Do check it out, www.thenewexpat.com. We've got expert expat webmaster John Galt and his daughter Jane Galt managing the site, so you'll get nothing but the straight poop.
South of the border.
You've been listening to The Expat Files, living in Latin America, coming to you twice a week from somewhere south of the border. Email me, theexpatfiles@gmail.com. And if you want me to help you sort out your own Latin American plans, schedule a one-on-one consult with me. Just send an email and let me know at theexpatfiles@gmail.com. Nos vemos.